the dark days are done and the bright days are here. My sunny one shines so sincere. Sunny one so true.
Our next guest is one of those rare talents who has something to say and can say it funny. He's a writer-performer on the new Laugh-In and one of the most popular, outspoken, and entertaining personalities on the local news here in Los Angeles. He's won a half a dozen Emmys as a film critic and host of his own shows. Let's welcome Mr. John Barber, right over there.
Thank you. This is John Barber, and that was Syreeta singing Sunny as Only She Can, and Frank Sinatra saying, here's Johnny, the night he hosted The Tonight Show. Welcome to John Barber's World, live here in Las Vegas on the day of the eclipse. And on the day of the eclipse, more revelations about the human comedy. I just ran across this news story. A cruise ship back east advertised that it was going to be taking on passengers across the ocean to follow the eclipse. 6,000 people bought tickets and boarded it. Never saw the eclipse or their money. Oh, my God. People are so weird and so funny. Look at this. How weird are people? I mean, there's a full moon once a month and nobody pays much attention to it. But hundreds of thousands flock to a tiny town in the Midwest to stare at a moon and a sun they cannot see. Now, this is a weird segue, but it'll have to suit its purpose. What has been eclipsed and not seen in America since they murdered John Kennedy is justice and peace and sanity and common sense. And we lost a lot of that again yesterday when comedian Dick Gregory died. Most people will not know Dick is a comedian. They'll know him as an outspoken social activist, a brilliant lecturer, and co-author, along with Mark Lane, of Murder in Memphis, about the government slaying of Dr. King. It was originally called Codename Zorro, J. Edgar Hoover's FBI codename for Dr. King. In the 70s, when I was a media critic at large at KNBC in Los Angeles, I tried to review it, but the news director wouldn't let me go on the air and kicked me out of the building. Public outrage brought me back to do that review, and as the news director feared, the American government did not collapse, unfortunately. The reason I will always remember Dick as a comedian is because that's what he was when I met him, and he enthusiastically did the liner notes of my first comedy album called It's Tough to Be White. The album went nowhere, but the hubbub over it brought me to the attention of Art Linkletter's Talent Scouts, where I was the only one of two performers to ever appear twice on that show. Unfortunately, I started to go somewhere because of Dick. As a comedian, Dick sparkled. He was a black Bob Hope, slinging out topical one-liners about American race while sitting casually on a stool smoking a cigarette, a very handsome man. He, and he alone, paved the way for every black comic that followed, especially Bill Cosby, who purposely avoided anything meaningful. White producers and network execs were so happy to find a black who wasn't a troublemaker, they fell all over Cosby to give him shows. Sadly, when we need it, there is now no comedian, black or white, with the wit of Dick Gregory or Lenny Bruce or George Carlin or Mort Saul or Bill Hicks or even Joan Rivers. This country is in desperate need of a comic mind that can turn the mountains of bullshit overflowing in Washington into funny fertilizer for the rest of us. Dick will now be making God laugh at the mess he made when he made man. Most of them, anyway. In Hamlet, Hamlet says, quote, "There are more things in heaven and earth, Horatio, than dreamt of in your philosophies," unquote. In an electric universe with only a limited light spectrum humans can see, there is obviously stuff going on out there that we know nothing about, At least most of us, anyway. Scientists say the best of us only use 5% of our minds. Can those who are gifted with more see more? I've always avoided thinking about things metaphysical because to me they're intangibles. But truthfully, I have seen two remarkable incidents in my life of proven psychic visions. And this makes me wonder. And as you've heard me say often about our film, The American Media and the Second Assassination of President John F. Kennedy, I actually truthfully believe somehow the universe has blessed this film. They say curiosity killed the cat, but in many instances, maybe curiosity cured the cat. So now, being curious about this subject, I figured there's no one better to explore it with than my guest tonight. She's called America's leading psychic and astrologer. She's appeared frequently on everything from coast to coast to CNN and even crime shows, author of over a half a dozen books, including her fascinating personal memoir, Unlimited Realities. And I'm happy to say she's one of the most popular, if not the most popular, host of her own show right here on BBS Radio, Elizabeth Joyce. Elizabeth, thank you so, so much for being here.
Oh, it's my pleasure. And you know, you took me down memory lane because a lot of the people you talked about, I have met in person. My older sisters were the Tony twins. Which twin has the Tony?
You're kidding.
Television. No, my older sisters were the Tony twins in black and white television before they filmed commercials. They had to do it live.
Oh, my gosh. Well, I tell you, you're going to be talking to a skeptic, as you could well tell from the introduction, but somebody who's truthfully deeply interested in the subject, because obviously there's more out there, as Shakespeare said, than are dreamt of in our philosophies. And I think your life has proven that. There's something in your book that truly moved me a lot. When I have a guest on that I admire and like, I always like to know a little bit about where they came from and how they became the people that I like and admire. And in your case, it struck me right away. So I'm going to ask you to expand on that. You described your family, the beginning of your book, you compared them to a decorated Easter egg.
I do.
When I saw that, I was stunned because I thought, am I going to read something fluffy here? And then you cracked the egg wide open. And you so moved me with that story. And I thought, do you know how many millions of families there are in America exactly like your family, Elizabeth? So tell us about why you described your family that way.
I told the truth. Everything in that book is true. That's what I experienced. That's how I saw it. And, you know, it's tough being the second set of identical twins, but it's tougher being the second born of the second set of identical twins. Now, nobody has done any research on the second set of identical twins, but twins are competitive not only with themselves, but with their parents and their peers. So the second set of twins has to be competitive with themselves, with their older sisters, and with their parents and their peers. Now, my sisters and I were 7 years apart. So by the time we were born, they were already singing and taking lessons and preparing to do entertainment, which they did very well. They were on Ed Wynn. They were on your show of shows. They were on Arthur Godfrey's Talent Scouts. They sang for Miss America pageants down in Atlantic City. They were doing all these things. And they were the Tony, one of the 16 pairs of Tony twins with my sisters. So when my twin and I were growing up, it got a little difficult. But when we went into high school, something happened. There was a show called American Bandstand with Dick Clark. And we started the rock and roll era. And that's when we decided that we wanted to be on that show. By the way, let me ask you something, John. Sure. Do you know who the first person was that sang rock and roll that was accepted by everybody?
Would I have to say Elvis Presley?
Oh, no. Before Elvis Presley, his name was Ricky Nelson.
Oh, yes, yes. Ozzie and Harriet Nelson's son.
Yeah, Ozzie and Harriet. And you watch him grow up. So when he started his music, people accepted it because they loved Ricky. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I thought the reason I say Elvis Presley, because evidently Elvis Presley sang the songs that were sung by black performers that went nowhere. But when Elvis sang them, even more so than Ricky, who was very successful, when Elvis sang them, he became a megastar. But the thing that I want to get back to is I want to get back to your observations about your mother and your father, which I found totally moving.
I don't know what to say. I really don't. I dealt with what I had. There was a lot of abuse. There was a lot of yelling and screaming and hitting and slapping and all those things. But the year at my grandmother's in New Hampshire really showed me how to get above it and how to survive.
Well, let me bring it up in case you sound like you're a little bit sensitive about wanting to talk about it. Talk about what your father was like as a person, about your mother's religiosity, her Christianity, and then move on to your grandmother, because it seems to me that that is proof that a child does not need two loving parents. A child just needs somebody who loves them. And I think that's evident in your book and in your life.
Well, yes, that's true. But you need to remember she was also family. I think it's difficult when it's not family. But that's true. My father was very self-centered, very Leo, very I'm on the planet. No one else is here but me. And he worked for Exxon. And he was never home, never home. He played bridge, he played golf, he was a life master, he ran track, he came second for the Olympics in 1928.
Wow.
And he was very, very active. I'm just trying to show you how active he was. And my mother was a small town girl who was a school teacher from New Hampshire. And they met, and she fell in love with him right away. And they married, and he brought my little one horse town mother down to the suburbs of New York City. And she didn't quite know how to meld in. She was not a status seeker. She didn't think the most important thing was what gloves you wore to church. She was a New England Baptist that was brought up by a shaman mother. Her mother was shaman.
Oh, really?
And so therefore, she took comfort in probably what she had learned. I felt very sorry for my mother, and I know it was very hard for her to cope. She almost died with both births, both sets of twins, and she lost another set of twins in the middle between us during that 7 years, and she did the best she could. She really did.
What was it in the family at the age of 8, I believe it was, you mentioned, that brought you to your grandmother's? And I must say, reading about your grandmother was so moving to me. Tell me about how she was with animals and the advice she would give to you when you would go out.
I had TB, and my mother didn't think the New Jersey air was good enough for me to heal. So she made me go to New Hampshire for a year. That's what the doctor said, that I would have it. I needed to heal for a year. And I went up and I lived with my grandmother. And my grandmother taught me a whole different set of rules. She didn't believe in hitting or spanking unless you had threatened somebody else's life. She handled it differently. And she wanted children to learn, when they made a mistake, what the mistake was all about, so that they could realize it and not do it again. So what she did was she made a sit-upon out of straw. So it's a mat that you sit on. Mm-hmm. And when I would do something that she didn't like, that was wrong, she would go to the back door and open the back door and stamp her foot and hold the sit-upon in her hand with that straight line, no smile. And I would know I was in trouble. And so I would just go with tears in my eyes and take the sit-upon And I went out and I found my own pine tree. So I would walk down the back hill and go across the river, the Warner River, and sit against the pine tree and talk to the pine tree. And I talked to the pine tree and I said, you know, I did something wrong and I don't really understand why I did. Or I'd say, well, I wanted to. And then I'd have to get all that ego out of me. And finally, I would be able to walk back up and tell her what I did wrong, why she was angry, and why it was wrong.
Did your grandmother instruct you to lean against the tree and embrace the tree or feel the energy?
She was a shaman. Go find the tree. Find a pine tree. She wanted it to be a pine tree. But she said an oak was good enough, but they had pine trees up in New Hampshire. And it's strong enough to listen to what you have to say.
Did you actually, at that age, did you actually feel any kind of energy coming from
it? Oh, yes. Are you kidding? I still do it today. I absolutely did feel the energy of the pine tree. As a matter of fact, what I felt was a warmth and a love. The pine tree was wordless. It didn't have to say a thing. I could say anything to it. I could kick my feet, knock my head against the tree, and it would just stand there and be strong.
Did you develop a talent for talking to the animals that was evidenced with your grandmother?
Telepathically. Well, my grandmother, at 10 o'clock in the morning, my cousin and I would watch my grandmother go outside, and we were instructed to be very quiet, not to jump up and down and giggle, and to just watch. And she'd go with a big hat, a big sombrero hat, and an apron with many pockets, and she'd fill it all with bird food and other foods like bananas and corn cobs. She'd save all the corn cobs after dinner, and she'd go outside and she'd sit. And she'd like become almost a pine tree. She'd sit on the front lawn, and all the animals would come, the chipmunks, the raccoons, the squirrels, the birds, the ravens, and they would eat. And they would have their lunch, they would have their breakfast, lunch, whatever it was. And she would go out for about a half an hour and let them enjoy the food. And then she'd always leave a little dish of food out there when she came in. And she'd always make sure that the animals had water. She wanted the animals to have water. And I learned that.
When was the first time you felt you were truly different in a way that you had visions and experiences and thoughts that you didn't think anybody else had?
I didn't really know that till I was an adult. But I'll tell you another lesson that made me wonder about it. I was going down to the spring at my grandmother's house to bring the water up for the day, and I saw a bird flapping on the lawn, and I knew it was hurt, and I ran up to the house, and I said, Grammy, the bird is dying. We have to help the bird. So she came down with me, and she said, open your right hand. And I opened my right hand and made it flat, and she laid the bird on my right hand with the beak at the fingertips and the tail at the wrist. And she said, now put your left hand over the right hand, and you don't have to touch the bird. Just put it over the right hand and vibrate it. And she said, do you feel that energy? And I said, yes. And she said, now let's say a prayer that the bird can heal. And we said a prayer to God and asked God to heal the bird. And all of a sudden it flipped its wings and flew off.
That's like the laying on of the hands. It's
That's
astonishing.
Right. Exactly what it was.
Well, you had a shaman, I guess, for a grandmother. Then did your siblings develop any of these?
No.
I guess we have to call them talents or gifts. Why do you think it was you?
Well, because I was quiet, I was shy, I had been sickly. I spent a lot of time reading, and I spent a lot of time in quiet, because that's what I needed to heal. But that also opened me up inside. And a lot of people aren't gifted the way others are. After all, John, you can't sing like Frank or Barbara Streisand, and neither can I. But they've worked at it their whole life. And I think I was very lucky to go up to New Hampshire and have that year. It was a blessing.
Well, you have that experience, but that probably is not what you wanted to do as a youngster, because your older twins, they went on to become singers and dancers. And I loved the part of the book where you talk about you wanted to be a singer and a dancer, because I love singers and dancers. And I happen to be married to a fabulous singer. You heard her at the top of the show. She sings like that to this day. She can still dance like Eleanor Powell.
Oh,
and
wow.
That's not what you ended up doing, but you tried to do it. So
I did. Because I dated Bobby Darin. I met Bobby Darin at American Bandstand, actually in Atlantic City. It was a Saturday night show, and we were down there with Dick, and there was a party after the show, and we went to the party, and Bobby was in the back of the room. And I went to the back of the room, and I started to talk to him because I was shy. And everybody else was talking, and I just kind of went to the back of the room to see who was back there. And he said his name was Bobby Darin, and he wanted Dick Clark to play his song, Splish Splash, on American Bandstand.
Wow.
And then he told me how he had made Splish Splash and how he had made the water. And he wound up, of course, Splish Splash became a hit. And he wound up going on the show, and then he came down to my house and met my father, and I have that whole chapter of what happened. But we were friends for years.
Oh, wow. It's just astonishing, because Bobby and I was Bobby Darin's opening act at the Sands Hotel. We were the last act there before they brought the building down. And it's interesting that you mentioned that you had to be alone, because that's what you needed to heal. And knowing Bobby as well as you did, he was confined to bed for years, and that's how he became a musician. And
he had a magic fever.
Yes, exactly. And he was so afraid that he would be dead before he was 26.
Before 25. Yep, he sure was.
Oh, that's just, I loved him. And he quit the business for 2 years after Bobby Kennedy was killed and went off and wrote a beautiful song. Spent many, many days with Bobby at the beach. He was wonderful to my young son at the time.
Taking the train into New York, and he was doing a mix with somebody by the name of Johnny Mercer. And they were in there, and they were doing the Ace song. And Ace in the Hole. Oh, my God, what a riot. I'll never forget that. It was so powerful. And then people recorded it, but I don't think that Johnny and Bobby meant for it to be recorded, but it was recorded, and it was terrific. They released it after his death.
Well, they were both extraordinary, extraordinary talents. I mean, even Johnny Mercer, it's like Louis Armstrong. They don't have great vocal instruments, but they sing beautifully, like Nat King Cole.
He was a writer and an arranger and everything. Johnny Mercer was terrific.
Wonderful. Okay, now, what is it that you, obviously you have this gift that you have, but you're trying to do other things with your life. So what were some of the kinds of jobs that you had before you finally realized that your gift is what you do now?
Well, I first started out with accounting, and my first job was at a bank in Ridgewood, New Jersey. And then I went to college. I went to Green Mountain College in Pulteney, Vermont. I married young. I had my babies before I was 25. I have two boys. And I went through that marriage. I got a divorce, and I married again. And I the love of my life, Joe, he died 3 years after we were married. He just died. He had a heart attack. And that, plus during that year, his oldest son had been murdered, and his body had been buried at Teterboro Airport. So,
oh my God,
that's where I wound up working. I wound up working at Teterboro, and I was there for almost 10 years, and I met everybody, including the people you've mentioned and Bill Cosby. We did corporate jets. So all of the stars and important people would fly into Teterboro. You know, it's the second largest airport in the New York City area. People don't really realize that.
Wow, goodness gracious. It's so fascinating. Okay, now, there's a chapter in your book, I believe it's called When the Student is Ready, the teacher will appear.
That's right.
Okay,
that's an old Buddha saying. Buddha said that when the student is ready, the teacher appears, and that's when I met Meg.
Well, it's almost like what Joseph Campbell said, if you follow your joy, there will be doors that will open in the universe to assist you that you don't even know exist. So obviously, you must have been searching or wondering about what it is that
I had the dream about the car crash in Houston, Texas every night for 3 weeks. I had this dream. Your aunt died. She's in Houston, Texas. My aunt was in Concord, New Hampshire. I kept having this dream, and I saw the oil wells and the trailer park, and I saw this body fly out of the top of the house and land in the tumbleweeds way in the back. And every day for three, finally, I thought I was going crazy. I couldn't stop the dream. It's like watching an eclipse. You can't stop the eclipse. So I called a friend of mine who was a social worker who actually had helped me and my children through my first divorce. And I called her up and I told her I thought I was going crazy. And I went to her office and I started telling her about my dream. And she turned white as a sheet. And she said, "You don't know me very well, but I was brought up in Houston, Texas. And my aunt is missing. They can't find the body. She was in the Houston oil well explosions. And you're telling me where the body is. And it's been 3 weeks and they've searched everywhere." And I said, "Well, let me draw you a map." And I took a piece of paper and I drew the house and I drew what I had seen in the dream. And I showed her where the body was and they found it in 3 hours.
Oh, my goodness gracious.
And we both were overwhelmed and scared and didn't understand it. I mean, I was like you then, John. I'd never had an experience like that. I'd had a lot of them, but not like that. And we both needed a teacher. So Brenda was looking and I was looking and she found Meg. And that's how we got to Meg.
Tell us about Meg now.
Oh, Meg was wonderful. Meg was a short woman like my mother. And I went up to see her that day for the appointment. It was a psychic astrology appointment. And she opened the door and I cried out, "Mother." And we ran into each other's arms and I cried. And she explained to me that the feeling that I was sensing was from a past life. And then she looked at the astrology and she saw the connection between the two of us. And she began to teach me. And she taught me most of what I know.
Well, how can somebody, you know, maybe you can be taught to play the piano or you can be taught to paint. How can anybody teach you how to read your visions or what is happening inside of your own mind?
She taught me about the other energies. She taught me about the chakras, which are the energy muscles of our body. She taught me about natural things, which, of course, all harmonized with what Grammy had taught me. And she taught me how to meditate in a certain way that would bring in visions. But not only that, she taught me how to put visions out called manifestation, that if I wanted something, I could do certain things to bring it into reality.
Well, and now comes a point then in your life that you realize this is the gift you have.
Yep.
And this is what it is that you wish to pursue. Now comes the practicality of how do you go about earning a living doing something like this?
It was very hard, John. I was on food stamps for 5 years and I had 2 children. But I walked away from corporate. I walked away from it because it was false. It was ego-centered. People lied and cheated and hurt other people. And I wanted no part of it. And I started doing healing work and readings. And I worked with teachers. I worked with Louise Hay. I worked with Dr. Deepak Chopra. I worked with the Clear Light Group, and I learned. And I was very, very good at what I did. I was very, very good at what I'm still doing, as they say. And there are not many people who have such a sharp talent, but it's the same thing as learning how to sing or learning how to dance. It's just different.
The two incidents that I know of proven psychics, one was Peter Hurkos, who was a Dutchman. He was painting his house, and he fell off the house onto his head when he was a teenager. And from that point on, he had visions. The same thing happened with my wife. My wife could touch something. They call it psychometry. You can touch
something. That's right, and sense the energy in it.
That's right. Well, yep. She was carrying our son. I don't want to tell the Peter Hurka story because it's kind of gruesome, in spite of the fact that you've solved a lot of crimes. My wife was pregnant. Her father was 63, looked exactly like Anthony Quinn. He looked 43 years of age. She hugged him goodbye. We were living in Los Angeles at the time. And for a week, she couldn't stop crying every single day. And I didn't know what to do. And I thought, well, I didn't believe in psychiatrists. I just didn't know.
He was going to go, right?
Yeah. And I finally said to her, you have to tell me what's wrong. Well, she knew I was a doubter about these things. And she finally said, I'm not going to see my father again alive. Yeah. Well, I was shocked. How could she say such a sweet lady say such a thing? And she said, I said, how can you say that? She said, I felt him. And I said, you're nuts. I really thought she was nuts. The next day, he died of a heart attack. He had had a clot in his leg that was misdiagnosed. It went to his heart and killed him.
So when she hugged him, she got that message. And
exactly.
You know, you can see this, John, with mothers and their babies. They sense everything. If they can be down in the basement, the baby's crying on the third floor, and this was before we had all of the baby things we have now, and they'd run up because they'd know something was wrong.
Well, now you solved this with this horrible nightmare you had of this auto crash and the ant flying through the window.
Mm-hmm.
There must have come a time when you thought of a homicide, you thought of a murder, you thought of something weird.
Absolutely.
And did you approach the police because you thought you could help them?
Let me tell you one story that's famous. The president of Exxon, John Riso.
Yes.
This was in, I think it was in 1992 or 93. Now, my father had worked for Exxon for 49 years. And I think that people need to understand that just because you're psychic doesn't mean you pick up every little thing. Because you couldn't live on the planet if that happened. You pick up what's on your timeline. My father worked for Exxon. The president of Exxon was murdered. I put on the television set, and they were saying that his body was missing. I was told to put on the television set by my guides, my inner guides, put on the television. And this was April 28th, 1993, I think. And I did. And there was the story. And I sat down and I looked out the window and I saw the whole thing in a black and white movie. I saw a blue Cadillac backing out of the garage. He got in the car. He was a gray-haired man with glasses. He got in the car. He was backing out the car down his driveway. And a girl was running, a girl with a visor hat on and a ponytail. She was blonde. And she screamed and she fell and he stopped the car. He left the door open. He left the motor running. I knew that. And he went to see if he had hit her. He thought he had hit her, which was the game anyway. That's what they wanted him to think. So he went out to help her to see if she was all right. And a man came out of the bushes with a gun and he made him go into the van. Now, the white van, Mr. Riso struggled and he was accidentally shot in the shoulder. I saw all that. I said he's in a closet. I gave the numbers of this closet, which was really a storage unit, but I saw it as a closet. I was so shaken by that vision. I didn't know what to do. But I had a girl in my classes who had three brothers in the FBI. So I called her up. And I told her what happened to me, and I was sobbing. And I said, please, I'm being used as a channel. I know I can help here. And she had them call me, and I spoke with the task force group out of Morristown, New Jersey, and I told them what was going on. And I remember telling Mr. Cartoon, his name was, that he was in a closet. And then I said, now they're moving him. And they're going down either the Garden State Parkway or the New Jersey Turnpike. And he said, well, you're probably right. We're looking around Newark Airport. I said, there's not anywhere near Newark Airport. He's in the pines. You have to find him. He's in a narrow grave between two pine trees. I would know that. I sat under pine trees for years. And I'm telling you, he said, "We're so frustrated. When do you think they'll find him?" And I said, "They're going to find him on June 30th, and it's going to be a married couple, and the man used to work somewhere in the building at Exxon."
Oh, my.
And that's exactly what happened on June 30th. They found him, and guess where they found him?
Between two pine trees.
They found him in Pinehurst, New Jersey, off
the shallow grave. Oh, my goodness gracious.
Between two pine trees and a shallow grave. Is that incredible or what?
That is incredible. Elizabeth.
But the thing that bothered me is, why couldn't that agent know Pinehurst, New Jersey? Well, his friends go to Pinehurst, you know?
Elizabeth, I must tell you, I have so many questions I want to ask you. So oh my gosh, I could talk to you all night. These stories are so interesting. Unfortunately, our time's up. Let me ask you a question. I would love you to come back because there are so many things I want to talk to you about. Or tell us if I could come on your show one night.
Sure.
On PBS. I would love to do that. And also, because I'm sure that when you do your show, you open it up so people can call in and talk to you.
I do have a call-in show. And, you know, anytime, we'll set a day for September or October. As you know, we're all going on vacation for a couple of weeks. So let's do it when the studio is back again.
Oh, that would be wonderful. Now, where can people go to get Unlimited Realities? Where can
Unlimited Realities is on Amazon.com. You just look up Elizabeth Joyce. It's also on my website, which is new-visions.com. But I do have a 24-hour answering service that you can call if you'd like to make an appointment. And that is 201-934-8986.
Repeat that again.
201-934-8986.
And what night and what time do you do your show?
It's at 9 o'clock. It's Let's Find Out.
Oh, Elizabeth, thank you so much for being here. And I'm really enjoying the book and the conversation. And I really look forward to meeting you one day, and especially doing your show and listening to these wonderful phone calls that come into you. Thank you so much, dear. Bless you and good luck.
Thank you.
We'll be right back with Joe Satilli to talk about News Vandal and what's going on in the world today. We'll be right back.
Great music from all the greatest performers from sunup to sundown.
How do you keep the music playing?
At last.
Well, beyond the sea.
Great talk all night. The mysteries of UFOs, conspiracy theories, and the true story of Las Vegas that has never been told.
There are three ways to listen to KIYQ. Go to the TuneIn app, just search for KIYQ, or go to www.kiyq.org. Listen from any telephone, call 605-477-2857. That's 605-477-2857. Long distance charges may apply.
KIYQ 107.1.
Hi, this is John Barber of John Barber's World every other Monday at 5 p.m. Pacific right here on VBS Radio. I'm telling you about a terrific show, The New Criminal Minds, with outstanding actor Gary Sinise, called Criminal Minds Beyond Borders. A tough drama about a special unit of the FBI involved in protecting Americans who are beyond borders. It follows the regular Criminal Minds, airing every Wednesday at 10 p.m. Eastern, 9 Central. Don't miss it. Gary Sinise is outstanding.
Hi, I'm Richard Belzer. This is the great BBS Radio.
Thank you for that smile upon your face. Oh, sunny.
Hi, this is John Barber. You may remember me as the co-host, producer, and creator of Real People, America's first reality show, or most recently as the writer-director of what's been called the definitive documentary on JFK's murder, The Last Word on the Assassination. Now I'm doing a show every other Monday from 5 to 6 Pacific Time on BBS. You'll hear provocative views, unreported news, and film reviews from me, with outstanding guests and you. Join me on John Barber's World.
You're listening to BBS Radio. If it's not mainstream, it's on bbsradio.com.
Those of you who have an ongoing interest in the JFK assassination might want to know about this. TV producer John Barber, he put together a dream team of JFK researchers, including Coast regular Jim Mars and world-class JFK writers Dick Russell and Joan Mellon. They all got together at UNLV in front of a live audience. They had a screening of Barber's terrific, and I'd say historic, film based on interviews with prosecutor Jim Garrison of New Orleans. And then after the film was shown, the experts all talked about the latest JFK theories and evidence. It's now out on a DVD. Terrific stuff. I'm George Knapp, Coast to Coast AM.
Welcome back to John Barber's World, and I want to thank George Knapp for that wonderful endorsement of The Last Word on the Assassination, which now you'll be able to see free up on my site. And for those of you who want to see the Garrison tapes, the first Garrison tapes free, you go to YouTube/ John Barber's World, and you can see every one of those episodes. And for those of you who want to listen to segments from It's Tough to Be White with the liner notes by Dick Gregory, that's up there also. And right now, I want to welcome my favorite newsman in the entire world now that Ed Murrow is no longer with us. That's Joe Satilli, creator of News Vandal. And Joe, welcome to the show. There are two things that I guess moved me about your News Vandal, even though they were near the bottom of the page. One was the stuff about Dick Gregory. And the other one that struck me really sad was 50 years since the Flower Child generation.
Summer of Love, yeah. And it's actually, there's an art exhibit here in, across the bay from me in San Francisco. So it's been in the local papers. It's been in local news. It's, you know, people opining about what was there in that moment that seemed to be something glorious and how it disappeared so quickly. You know, the story is, the general history is that the flower power generation died just about 30 miles from San Francisco at a place called Altamont in 1969, when the Hell's Angels were hired to be the security by the Rolling Stones, and they went out into the audience throughout the entire concert and beat on all of the hippies. Ironically, that was, I think it was in September or August. I was born September, August 1969 here in Northern California. So it's kind of like a flashpoint, and it does, you know, John, you started the show talking about comedy, and your listeners know that I'm a big comedy head. Of course, they know you are a comedy icon yourself. And you were hearkening back to Dick Gregory. You know, when I lived in D.C., I used to walk Rock Creek Park, get a little power walk in. And on a regular basis, Dick Gregory would be coming in the other direction. We seemed to be on the same schedule, but he was going south and I was going north on Rock Creek. And so we would pass by all the time. You know, it was a different time insofar as there still felt like there were possibilities and new vistas to explore in music and culture, and particularly in comedy. And I did take note of the fact that you were lamenting the fact that it doesn't seem like there's anybody to encapsulate the way Lenny Bruce or Mort Saul or Dick Gregory or Jack Parr or Will Rogers or Mark Twain did in previous generations to encapsulate and crystallize what the challenges are.
No, it's as though America lost its sense of community. It just, it vanished. And you no longer, you know, we were talking with Elizabeth in the first part of the show. There was a time in America when psychics and intellectuals were applauded. I mean, there was no more popular psychic in the world than Edgar Cayce. Right. I mean, his books still sell in the thousands, and intellectuals were all over the place, even in television, because in television, it was a box that they had to sell. And in order to sell that box, they had to put something in the box. So they raided all the vaudeville shows, Milton Berle and all of the rest of them, gave them shows. People would buy the box. And then they realized that people also listen to people who talk. And they find a Bishop Fulton Sheen who ends up beating out Milton Berle, put him on television. Well, even if it was somebody like the CIA's William F. Buckley, at least he was articulate and he was intelligent, even though he was misled.
No, and he would go toe-to-toe with James Baldwin and Gore Vidal. And
exactly. And that does not exist in America anymore. So I don't think, you know, I think that Chris Hedges may be right when he says that Donald Trump may be our last president. I did a show this morning back east. They were doing a memorial on Dick Gregory, and they knew that Dick was a friend of mine and had done the line. And so we were on the show, and they played a clip of Dick's. And Dick had written a book about why I'm afraid of the shadow. He said, because the shadow is darker than the object that it is lighting. Which seems to be quite true. I remember seeing a movie called The Black Cat, and they would show the shadow on the wall, and the shadow scared me more than the black cat. They always did that in horror movies. And he says that the Trump presidency has cast a shadow over America, which terrifies him. Now, of course, sadly, he died, and I think he may have died because of an infection that he got being treated in a hospital. 80,000 Americans die in hospitals of infections that they get when they're in the hospital. Anyway, talk to me a little bit about your impressions of Dick Gregory and where the state of humor is today, and then get to one of the other subjects in your news vandal that you really want to talk about.
Well, I mean, there are a number of ways to go. One thing that strikes me, you know, you talked about a loss of community. And I think one of the reasons why we had the eclipse mania, which I think you think is kind of funny. I think it's kind of funny. You know, it's not like eclipses are really that rare. They happen fairly often, actually. But I think one of the reasons why people are beside themselves with the opportunity to be a part of the eclipse is not just because they want to say the word totality, even though they don't even know what that means, but I think because they want to participate in a communal event. We don't really have communal spaces anymore. You're talking about television. Look, everybody knows this. There was a time when it was three major networks, and then you had the UHF channels, your local channels. You may have had one or two independent channels if you were lucky enough to live in a major metropolitan area. Then you had the UHF channels, which were often sort of seat of their pants operations. And one of the reasons why they had a lot of those great public service type programs was because you had to do that to get your FCC license. If you wanted an FCC license, you actually had to show a certain amount of religious programming and public service programming and children's programming. You know, I read old TV guides, as you well know, and you read the lineups on these channels in the late 60s and the 70s and even into just about the early 80s when cable started to disrupt everything. And you think, my gosh, that some of these things, it's almost like a college syllabus compared to what television
you made. You made an observation that people overlook. And I must tell you, as a movie critic, how much I agree with you when you talk about the eclipse and people get together by the thousand, because it's a communal, it's community. Yep. And the sense of community is as deep in us as is the need for food or the need for sex. It's the need to be a part of a community. I have had dozens and dozens of people, producers and directors and writers, say, well, movies are over with. And I must tell you, in spite of the fact that a lot of really good movie making is over with, there will always be theaters. Even in New York, where they're showing nothing but reruns, people want to congregate in a theater for a feeling of community. Now, here near where I live, here in Las Vegas, not far away, they have the Utah Shakespeare Festival, which you never hear about, and it's always sold out. Right. It's a great sense of community, and they're going to listen to stuff that most of them can't even understand.
Right. Well, it's that shared experience. And, you know, television used to offer that. And you know this because you had a show with, 50 Share. I mean, just ridiculous thing. And a good example of, you look at the shows of Norman Lear, like All in the Family. All in the Family was a show that an episode would run, and it was the water cooler discussion for the next 2 days.
Exactly.
And that doesn't happen anymore. And things are so atomized. And when we think, you know, you said that, you know, Dick Gray was talking about the shadow that Trump has cast on America. In some ways, I think Trump is our collective shadow looking back at us. I tend to not think of Trump as a cause so much as a symptom. And the atomization of our shared experiences into little tribal units and groups has been on display over the last, I mean, really since for a long time, it's been building. I think the Trump campaign was one in which it was basically based on these sort of racially coded messages and tribalism. And now we've seen it in the last 10 days with the, you know, the sudden emergence for a lot of people. It's not sudden. Believe me, it's been going on for a long time. I've studied them for 25, 30 years, what became the alt-right and what used to be the Christian identity movement in Hayden Lake, Idaho in the late 80s, early 90s, and White Aryan Resistance and these other groups. But people are now sort of shocked into this realization that we have become this atomized tribal society that is struggling for communal experience. You know, you're talking about music with your previous guest. I mean, there was a time when Casey Kasem's Top 40 aired every Saturday morning, and a huge portion, millions of Americans, got around the radio or they had it playing in the background while they were doing their gardening or doing their housework to find out what was this week's number one song. And we all participated in what was this week's number one song. And we were all kind of listening to the same music, and Top 40 music pulled from like 15, 20 different genres at some instances. And now we've all gone to our separate corners, our separate worlds, our little bubbles. And I think this is one of the downsides of technology is even though we seem to be more connected, we also seem to be more disconnected at the same time.
We are disconnected. And it seems that the only water cooler conversations now are about the latest screw-ups in Washington, D.C. or the latest football scores. And other than that, there is nothing.
John, I think one of the interesting things is that the football scores are starting to fade now. And, you know, the NFL is starting to struggle a little bit to hold viewership. And really, it is come down to bring it all the way full circle back to comedy. I think Jon Stewart is right there with people like Mort Saul, who I actually watch every Thursday live from the Throckmorton Theater on Periscope. He has a little live feed that he shows. He's still doing commentary. God bless him.
Tell me about it.
Yeah, it's on Periscope, which is connected to Twitter, and it's a live broadcast, and the Throckmorton Theater is up in Marin, and every Thursday at 7 o'clock, my phone dings, and I turn it on, and I'm able to watch him live opining about, I mean, he just does sort of a tour de force because, you know, he was so involved in particularly with the Kennedys. And he's just, as you know, I mean, this is a guy who people would come to see his act and he would get up there and start reading the Warren Commission report.
Yes, I know.
That's titanium testicles right there.
At one time he was going to do the liner notes along with Dick Gregory on my album, but he got really upset. I went to visit him at his house in Beverly Hills, and he told me the story about how Joe Kennedy had destroyed his career. And the story he told me was that he had gotten a call from Joe Kennedy asking him, the president was still alive, and asking him to quit making jokes about the liberals. Because he felt it was Joe Sr. felt that it was the liberals that who would reelect his son in 1964 and told him that he should get into movies. And Mortzel said, I'm not a Jewish Cary Grant.
And Joe Kennedy said, Jerry, there was ever any
so Joe Kennedy said, don't worry, we'll get you into the movies. So anyway, a personal manager came along and helped to get him into a movies. And one of the lines in the movie, he was in a war movie. And he had one line that brought the house down. The phone rang while he was in a trench. And he said, World War II, which is brilliant. And that was Mort. But he said what happened is then Kennedy got shot in Dallas and his career was over with. Because he had done Joe Kennedy a favor by laying off of his son with his jokes and through getting into movies for which he was totally ill-suited, except as a writer. So he had this rage against the world because he felt there was nobody quite like him, and there was nobody quite like him, and he resented the fact that I thought that Dick Gregory was his equal in order to do the liner notes, and I had to make a choice. Well, of course, with the title, I get stuff to be white. I had to choose.
Yeah, you got to go with Gregory. With
Dick. And so Mort and I parted company. But tell us the next time you're going to be on Ocelli, where they can get.
Yeah, I'll be on Ocelli tomorrow. I'll be here in 2 weeks. Go to newsvandal.com and then go to Amazon. Second assassination of John F. Kennedy. The thing is, it's $1.99, right?
$1.99.
$1.99. It's doing great guns over there, folks. You got to go see it. And you might want to see it more than once because John Barber is one of the greatest writers I've ever encountered. And it comes through in the movie.
Oh, Joe, thank you so much. Thank you so much for listening. As Ed Murray used to say, good night and good luck.
A sunny, 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 I love you.